Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In no particular order, here's where we are today. Big banks are still big and darn proud of it. Virginia voters and the economics of Super Tuesday and life after the start button. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 29th of February. Good as always to have you with us. And the ticker symbol of the day today is NEWS. Put it all together, it speaks for itself. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, owner of Fox News and The Wall Street Journal, traded higher all day in New York, even as corporate events overseas looked quite grim. Actually, Murdoch's son James quit today as the executive chairman of News International. That's the company's British newspaper publishing subsidiary. And he may be the boss's kid, but James is also the latest high-profile News Corp executive to be swept up in the growing phone hacking scandal. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the media business story of the day.
James Murdoch's demise had been in the cards for months. A public inquiry has heard evidence that some of the newspapers he controlled routinely hacked into people's cell phones and corrupted the police. Harriet Harman is deputy leader of the opposition Labour Party.
After the evidence this week of wholesale bribing of the police, James Murdoch had to go.
Yesterday, there were even more toxic claims that one of his papers may have conspired to subvert a murder inquiry to protect a couple of private eyes that the newspaper employed. This afternoon, lawmakers like Chris Bryant were lining up to denounce the fallen executive.
I think that James Murdoch's resignation from News International is long overdue. After all, he's brought some of the most important newspapers in this country into disrepute.
Rupert Murdoch, however, today paid tribute to his son's stewardship of News Corp's British newspapers. And James Murdoch does remain a senior executive at the parent company. He's focusing on its much more profitable pay TV interests. Tim Luckhurst, professor of journalism at Kent University, thinks this could be the beginning of the end of News Corp's long love affair with newspapers.
I think that there will be a great deal of pressure from amongst the independent shareholders at News Corporation to argue the case that the future of the group does not lie in the outdated medium of print.
But what role James Murdoch will play in the future of News Corp is far from clear. Once he was the heir apparent, but no longer, not after the resignations, says Michael Price-Jones, who speaks for a group of independent shareholders in the US.
It shows, I think, US investors that this guy can't be trusted by his own dad to run these businesses.
Perhaps the biggest casualty of today's resignation has been Rupert Murdoch's dynastic ambitions. First, it was to be his daughter, Elizabeth, who would succeed him, then his son, Lachlan, and then James. The elderly tycoon is running out of heirs apparent, and perhaps finally facing the truth of what his own newspapers frequently preach to the monarchy-supporting Brits. The best way to create a leader is not by the hereditary principle. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back in the deepest days of the financial crisis, it seemed like every time you turned around, J.P. Morgan Chase was the last bank standing. It bought up struggling or bankrupt rivals. It made bigger profits than anybody else did. And if CEO Jamie Dimon has his way, it's going to stay like that. At an investor conference yesterday, Dimon said he would be damned, his word, not mine, if the bank doesn't keep turning in record profits. If it's any consolation, none of that's coming off our backs. Another executive at the meeting said that most Chase customers with less than $100,000 in their accounts just aren't profitable. Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
Randy Senatori is a cleaning supervisor in New York City. He doesn't have anything like $100,000 in his bank account at Chase.
I'll just be one of the people that, I guess, doesn't get the attention, like the elite that are running our country.
Chase officials said it's not as if the bank wants to reject people with less than $100,000. That's most of its depositors. Instead, it wants them to use more apps and online banking, services that cost less for the bank to provide. Fair enough, right?
The average American consumer today visits a branch 2-3 times a year.
That's Brett King, who wrote Bank 2.0, a book about the future of banking. Still, Chase plans to open 900 more branches over the next 3 years. Bert Ely, a banking consultant, said banks think branches attract wealthy customers.
They're higher net worth customers, not only buy a broader range of services, but are more likely to visit a branch.
When rich customers walk into a branch, it gives Chase a chance to hook them for more expensive services, like managing their wealth, which is where the real profit lies. Even so, King believes banks would do well to sound less high-handed with their regular customers.
It's almost this philosophy is you'll be lucky if we let you be our customer.
Since most people are reluctant to switch banks, it seems they can live with an arrogant tone as long as they don't have to pay more fees. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
There was an ever-so-slight thaw in relations between the United States and North Korea today. In return for Washington starting up aid shipments again, food in particular, North Korea agreed to suspend its nuclear weapons program and allow international inspections. You can put this one in the "hey, sometimes sanctions do work" column. Our Washington Bureau Chief Don Dimsdale has the story.
North Korea has agreed to a moratorium on nuclear weapons and long-range missile tests, and in return, the U.S. will begin shipping food aid to the famine-stricken country. So was it the food that brought the North Koreans around? Jack Pritchard, a former U.S. representative at talks with North Korea, doesn't think so.
It's relatively modest, 240,000 metric tons of nutritional assistance. Now, what that is fortified biscuits and things that are meant for babies, small children of that nature. It is not an attractive food substitute in terms of grain that the North Koreans would want.
So maybe North Korea is eager for an end to economic sanctions, which the U.S. and its allies imposed after Pyongyang confirmed nuclear weapons tests in 2006. But Pritchard says the sanctions weren't very effective.
The safety valve for North Korea with regard to the biting of the sanctions has been China. They've allowed a lot of things to go through to North Korea, and so the North Koreans have not been hit hard by the sanctions.
Instead, he says, this agreement is an attempt by the new 20-something leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, to establish some political credentials at home.
A sense there may be a period of normalcy that's going on now. So it was important for them for political reasons, not for food, not for sanctions, not for threats.
Will this agreement lead to further breakthroughs? Marcus Nolan at the Peterson Institute for International Economics sees reason for hope.
I think it is a good sign that the first political move of the new leadership in Pyongyang is a conciliatory move and not a belligerent move. The alternative to having an agreement could have been waking up one morning in a few months and finding out they had done another nuclear test. So this is obviously a preferable outcome.
Both the White House and State Department said today's agreement is positive, but only a first step toward a permanent shutdown of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke went to Capitol Hill today. The Fed chairman said what he's been saying, for a couple of years now. Wall Street reacted accordingly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Almost got run over by an electric car the other day while I was out running. My fault, totally. It was dark. It was early. I wasn't really paying attention. But I will say that car was really quiet. There was, as it happens, a big breakthrough in the world of electric cars this week. A Silicon Valley startup says it's got a new battery that could greatly increase the range and decrease the price of cars that don't make any noise. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Envia Systems has been working for 4 years on the holy grail for electric cars, a cheaper battery that goes a couple hundred miles or more on a single charge, rather than the 80 or so of today's Nissan Leaf. Envia Systems believes it's getting close. CEO Atul Kapadia.
What we want to do is we want to minimize the cost of this material sufficiently that a 200-mile car costs no more than $25,000. And a 300-mile car costs no more than $35,000.
Still not cheap, but getting there, says auto analyst Michelle Krebs.
This could be a game changer.
Keyword there is could, says electric car expert Jay Tankersley at Rocky Mountain Institute.
It's one thing to actually produce a highly efficient, highly cost-effective battery in the lab, but to actually make something that can be put into a GM or put into a Nissan Leaf, that is a totally different game.
Tankersley says that's because batteries need to be tested thousands of times over under different conditions, and scaling up to mass production is always fraught with unexpected problems. But Envia CEO Kapadia insists he's not trying to hype anything here. He says he just wants automakers to know one thing. Electric car batteries are getting better.
They begin to realize that indeed they can make money on these electric cars. And if they can make money on these electric cars, they continue to pump more money into those programs and promote those vehicles.
Kapadia may hope that General Motors in particular gets that message. Right now, GM is Envia's biggest investor. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Once and perhaps future Republican frontrunner Mitt Romney went to Toledo, Ohio today. With Michigan and Arizona behind him, Romney and the other three GOP hopefuls are all about Super Tuesday this week. 10 states are going to be voting next week. We'll be in 5 of them in the coming days, including a broadcast from Atlanta next Monday for our coverage of what actually matters in this election. That'd be the real economy. Swing states are getting a lot of attention, as they do every year. President Obama won Virginia in 2008, thanks in part to newcomers to the Commonwealth, voters who were changing the way that Virginia swings. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
In presidential elections, Virginia was a reliably red state for decades. President Obama was the first Democrat to win the state since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Virginia is now bright purple, up for grabs, because of people like 32-year-old Kurt Hall.
I would say that I'm a Democrat.
Hall is sitting on a bench at a bus stop in downtown Arlington, Virginia, just outside Washington. He moved here from Ohio and works as a freelance stage manager. Hall voted for President Obama in 2008 and will support him again this year, even if the economy goes south. Hall is more concerned about preserving Medicare and Social Security.
You have to take care of people because not everyone can take care of themselves, but also it's just the right thing to do.
Hall is part of a wave of young, college-educated whites who've moved to Northern Virginia, one of the most prosperous areas of the country, thanks to federal government spending. These voters backed President Obama 4 years ago. They're part of a whole new mix of people who live in Northern Virginia now and are not reliably Republican. Also in the mix, African Americans, like 24-year-old Lauren Hill, a student who also lives in Arlington.
He got my vote because I never saw someone who could talk to me and to my mom and to the Spanish lady who works in my apartment building and get us all together and believe that we can all come together as a country and do something.
Hill says she'll vote for Obama again this year. Hispanics and Asian Americans also lean toward the president. Manjog Singh moved to the U.S. from India in 1999. He drives a cab in Arlington. He says Obama also has his vote this year, but the president has to do more for low-income Americans.
He has to do something for the very low-class and middle-class, because then the economy is going to go up.
And voters here do have one eye on the economy. If it gets shaky, Republicans have a better chance of luring votes away from President Obama. Larry Sabato heads the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. He says the Virginia economy will suffer when the federal government starts cutting spending.
In most families, you have at least one person who is employed by the federal government. When the federal government cuts fat from its budget, it's cutting muscle in a place like Virginia.
Most of the planned cuts in the federal budget won't take place until next year, after the election. But Virginia voters are also paying attention to the national economy, according to Rui Teixeira, a sociologist and senior fellow at the Progressive Center for American Progress. He's been studying the economics and population shifts of this election. He says minorities and white college graduates have increased their share of the Virginia vote since 2008, while white working class voters declined by 5 percentage points. They tend to vote Republican. Teixeira says Virginia's demographics work in President Obama's favor, but
the thing that could interfere with that is people's sense that the economy hasn't improved enough and maybe it's time for a change and maybe the other guy can do better. That's really what the struggle is going to be about in Virginia.
and what a struggle it will be. Teixeira concludes a report he co-wrote on Virginia's changing population by saying, quote, "The stage is set for a showdown of demographics versus economics in the 2012 election. This will be no election for the faint-hearted." In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you could look and there it was, in bold, simple letters in the corner. Start. It was a noun, an imperative command, a portal, all in one.
Life after the start button. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, Dow 13,000, we hardly knew you. The Dow Industrials fell 53 points today, 0.4%, closed at 12,952. The Nasdaq surrendered 19 points, 2/3%, 2966. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points, nearly 0.5%, ended things at 1365. As I mentioned, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke sounded cautious on Capitol Hill today, and that pretty much sapped the morning rally. Industrial stocks led the big board lower. Alcoa shares melted 1.9%. Machinery maker Caterpillar gave back 1.3%. ExxonMobil shed 0.75% today. High gas prices, however, helped retailer Costco. The chain's discounted prices at the pump lured shoppers, and the chain's quarterly profit impressed. Costco shares picked up 0.9% today. Maybe JPMorgan Chase has a point about touting its profits. It was the only big bank to trade in the black today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee discusses the crisis in Syria. What did you earn and how much of it left your wallet? The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for January. And maybe you went shopping, got a little something for your honey for Valentine's Day, or stuff for the house, or four or five pairs of shoes that you needed to complete your wardrobe. For now, chain stores report sales for February. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
To launch our new Wealth and Poverty Desk this week, our project about the causes and consequences of the growing economic divide in the United States, we've been hearing stories of people, of how they live their economic lives depending on their place in this economy. Today, two people who are comparatively well off, both of them small business owners, in the top 15 to 20% of American households.
My name is Rob Wininger. I'm 51 years old. I live in Sherman Oaks, California.
My name is Jean Cotis. I own Designer Jean Salon in Sparta, New Jersey.
I am the owner with my wife of F&R Interiors, and we specialize in window treatments.
What I do in the salon
shades,
is
blinds,
I do cuts and colors,
draperies, shutters. Just when I look at the world around us, we're probably more in the upper middle class. Although when we see some of our friends or the people that our kids hang out with, you know, they're much wealthier than we are.
I wouldn't put myself in upper middle class because my income goes up and down.
We've been carrying on this private school sort of culture.
My children, I pay tuition to go to Catholic school.
So it's been a huge, huge aspect of, you know, our budget.
I have no investments. I have no retirement accounts. I've invested in my children.
Try to save when we can, but when we have maybe $8,000, $10,000 in a savings account, that would be for emergencies. So we're worried.
Oh, my neighborhood. It's a small town. There's a lake. It's mostly a family town.
Definitely safe.
Mothers usually stay home with their kids. The husbands are out working.
I have four children. None of them have really had a job like we had. So I don't know if I'm helping them or if I'm hurting them. There's never been a society ever where you don't have a gap between the wealthy and the poor.
The wealthy people have always been the people that have taken care of the poor people, whether it be by employing them, or donating their time, donating their money.
There's someone who's working harder or who is smarter or who has created something should be given more than someone who's not. Yes, I think they deserve to be rewarded for their labors and their creativity.
So I'll make as much as I make depending on how good I am.
That was Gene Kotis from Sparta, New Jersey, and Rob Wininger from here in Los Angeles. We're going to need your help to tell this story of wealth and poverty in America in words and sounds and photos. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Our Voices of Wealth and Poverty were produced by Fiona Ng and Gina Delva. Even if you've never used it, you might still have heard of Yelp. It's the website that offers up user reviews, 2 stars, 3 stars, that kind of thing, for everything from restaurants and bars to barbershops. We're bringing it up because later this week, Yelp is going to get its own review of a different and perhaps much harsher kind. The company is set to offer its stock for sale to the public on Friday, Sally Herships reports.
Yelp has 66 million unique users. That's probably worth a couple of stars. It's one of the best-known review sites on the web. Star-worthy. And it's worked its way into popular culture.
Welcome to the City Grill. Please have a seat.
Look at this weird fork. Yelping.
It smells like food in here.
Yelp.
Oh, I can't believe this.
That's a video from the folks at Funny or Die. They're reviewing a pretend restaurant, but Yelp hopes to raise $100 million with a real IPO. Sandeep Trahia teaches finance at Georgetown. He says Yelp's rapid growth may make the company look stronger than it is.
It's easy for Yelp to have shown the growth rates it had shown because it was very small. It still is very small.
Drahia says the hype around the IPO is bigger than the company, which depends on local advertising for revenue. Rick Summer is an analyst with Morningstar. He says the company is not profitable and it's facing growing competition from Google and Facebook.
Calling on local salespeople that have questionable advertising budgets for and asking for small amounts of money, it's a real expensive way to try and make a buck.
That may be why Yelp's revenues have been growing more slowly. But Summer says when it comes to engagement, Yelp has one of the highest ratings of any site out there. Just listen to the rating Super Yelper Doris Gruber gives the site.
5. 5. 6 if I could.
But Yelp has received an average of 3 stars from over 4,000 reviewers on its own site. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There was a small but significant shift in the personal computing ecosystem today. Microsoft gave the world its first official look at the new version of the Windows operating system, Windows 8, technically. And for the first time in 15 years, there's a key piece of it missing, the little start button on the taskbar isn't there anymore. Commentator Jennifer 8 Lee says it's a sign we're maturing right alongside our technology.
We first saw it with Windows 95. It was the dawn of the networked age, and the start button was a beacon for those of us stumbling around the maze of folders and programs on our computers. You could look, and there it was, in bold, simple letters in the corner. Start. It was a noun, an imperative command, a portal, all in one. Microsoft had always been knocked as a copycat of other people's ideas, but the start button was the Seattle Giants' own invention. Indeed, patent number 5920316 was granted on July 6, 1999 to Microsoft for taskbar with a start menu. As the patent explains, the start menu acts as a centralized place for a user to gain access to programs, documents, system settings, help information, and the like. Don't remember where you saved that spreadsheet for work? The start button was there to help. Sick of your screensaver? The start button would guide you to the control panel, like an usher showing you to your seat. Thus, for millions, the start button was computing on training wheels. Lest we get too nostalgic, we should acknowledge that the start button has long been on the decline. In Windows Vista, the start button had been displaced by a shiny Windows logo. But the sentimental-minded still could delve into the settings and choose the Windows Classic look to revive it. In Windows 8, the button is gone. Of course, computing has come a long way since those classic days of yore. Back then, a computer was a bulky desktop with a dial-up modem, floppy disk drive, and a cathode ray tube monitor. Now, our computers fit in our pockets and have 4G connectivity, gigabytes of flash memory, and touchscreens. In the age of cloud computing and constant connectivity, things are always on. We no longer have to start them.
Jennifer Ait Lee is the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Send us your thoughts, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on this leap day, the economic advantages of adding a day to the year. Not a whole lot, it turns out. 1/366th of added economic activity doesn't really do much in the grand scheme of things. Individually, though, think about this. If you get an hourly wage, today was a chance to earn a little bit more money. If you're on salary, though, you basically worked for free. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 53 points, 0.4%. Blame Ben Bernanke, if you like. The NASDAQ surrendered 19 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 slipped 6 points, nearly 0.5%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. Hope you were paying attention to the music today, by the way. Let us know. Letters at marketplace.org. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.